Hey, are we live yet? Are we live yet? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's online podcast with your host, Jan Irvin. Here we investigate the religious, the mysterious, the entheogenic, the shamanic, and the Gnostic with the small g. Haven't heard it someplace else, you'll likely hear it here. So sit back and relax. Take a trip through time and a journey through your mind as we investigate the ancient mysteries. It is the night that frightens us. What lurks in the dark beyond our vision? Killing to heal, retributive killing, hunting human victims, tobacco, cannibals who come to eat your maba, the nectar of your decaying body. We cannot have light without the balance of darkness. This show is about balance. This show is about the dark shamans, the Kanema. Hold on as we take a trip to the dark side with Professor Neil Whitehead. But before we begin, I'd like to make a request to the listenership out there. This show is provided free of charge and free of any commercials. However, I must start asking for donations. I never suspected that the show would rise in popularity so quickly, and therefore I must start paying for bandwidth charges. So I encourage you to please go to www.gnosticmedia.com and make a donation, whether it's $1 or $10 or $100 or whatever you can afford. Every bit helps. Because of the show's sudden popularity and bandwidth usage, without donations, I may have to cut back to only 2 shows a month, or otherwise the podcast will be unavailable for several days each month until the next cycle rolls into effect. So if you can help with donations to help us keep going, please donate directly to either the GnosticMedia.com website, that's GnosticMedia.com, or on the GnosticMedia.podomatic.com website. And donations that are not used for bandwidth will go toward much-needed recording equipment so that the sound quality of the shows is more consistent and things like that. Lastly, I still have copies of my new book available in the first 100 copies, numbered and signed. If you are interested in purchasing a copy, they're available on the Gnostic Media website. All music in this episode is provided by Professor Neil Whitehead. The following song is an original Alleluia Shaman song to ward off the dark shamans of the night. Hold on, because this is one wild ride. Enjoy the show.
Hallelujah, one day,
Today I'm here with a very important guest that I've based a lot of my research around for the last several years. This is a subject that is widely suppressed in the mainstream scholarship of shamanism and South American, Mesoamerican history in general. I personally feel that my guest today is a pioneer in this field of study. And I'm talking about Professor Neil Whitehead, who is professor of anthropology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Whitehead graduated from Oxford University in 1984 with his PhD in anthropology. He's the author and editor of several books, including his latest, Hans Staden's True History, an account of cannibal captivity in Brazil, edited by him and Michael Harbsmeyer. And in 2005, he wrote Terror and Violence, Anthropological Approaches. In 2004, he wrote Violence, and one of my favorite books of his. And by the way, Neil, you are one of my all-time favorite authors.
Well, thank you,
Jan. You're welcome. His 2004 book, In Darkness and Secrecy, The Anthropology of Occult Sorcery and Witchcraft in Amazonia. And he wrote also in 2004, 19th Century Travels, Explorations and Empires, Writings from the Era of Imperial Consolidation. And then in 2003, he wrote Histories and Historicities in Amazonia. And probably one of his more famous works, at least to me anyway, and very important to my own studies, is his 2002 work, Dark Shamans, Kanema and the Poetics of Violent Death. And his first book, it looks like, was in 2001, Beyond the Visible and the Material. Welcome aboard, Neil. How are you today?
Very well. Thank you very much. It's good to be with you, and thank you very much for those generous comments. There are a few more books before 2001, actually, but let's not bore your audience any further.
I'm with that. So, can you tell me a little bit? So you went to Oxford University.
That's
sort of like a junior high, right?
Yeah, I guess. But of course, being originally British, although now I've naturalized to be an American, I never went to junior high, so I'm not too sure what that would have been like. But you know, certainly Oxford was a very traditional place when I went there. In fact, at that time, men and women were still in separate colleges, so that puts me back some time now.
And what led you to study at Oxford University?
Well, I mean, because I suppose, it really is a world-class university, and you might as well shoot high. You can only try, and I was very fortunate to be admitted, and I got what I would still consider a first-rate education there. I think it really has stood me in good stead.
And so you graduated with your PhD in anthropology in 1984. How did
Yeah,
you?
I went up there originally to read philosophy and psychology as an undergraduate. And basically, that was very interesting to me, but what was very apparent, at least to me anyway, that we needed to know whether these ideas of mind and these basic concepts of philosophy were in any way, useful to others other than, British or American. So really it was coming out of that started me in anthropology.
And what led you to the United States and the University of Wisconsin-Madison?
Well, it was a sort of dream come true. I mean, the phone goes one day and they say, "Well, we're hiring, and we think you might well suit the job. Why don't you make an application?" And it's worked very well since then. Certainly, anthropology is a much smaller field in England, and higher education was somewhat shrinking at the time, so it was a very welcome phone call, I must say.
So, why study South American indigenous cultures?
Well, again, it's sort of starting off in England. Anthropology there is traditionally very much concerned with Africa and Asia. So, a sense of space, maybe branching out somewhere a little unusual, at least within British anthropology. And so, that along with a kind of fascination with, I guess we all sense that the indigenous cultures, particularly of Amazonia, feel very different. I mean, they strike us as very different. So it was also that lure of something, frankly, very exotic that made that seem a good idea at the time.
So, who are the Patamuna?
Patamona, yes. Well, they're a Carib-speaking people. Carib is one of the major language families of South America, northern South America. And they live in the highland regions of Guyana. So very roughly, if you were to look on a map where Venezuela, Guyana, and Brazil meet, that point actually is Mount Roraima, which is about 100 miles distant from west of Patamona territory. So they live, some of your listeners may have seen some pictures of the tepuys in Venezuela. It's a very dramatic mountainous landscape of eroded basalt pillars. And the Patamona sort of occupy the heartland of that. So they too were, very remote and had not really been studied by at least an anthropologist at all. There had been some missionary and travel writing, but there'd been no ethnographic work done whatsoever amongst the Patamona, so they seemed a very interesting group to try and encounter and find more about them.
And you went to live with these people, is that
Yeah,
correct?
that's right. My first trip up there was back in 1992, and I subsequently made three or four trips, staying a number of months each time. Right through till 1997.
And could you tell us a little bit about their different forms of shamanism? From your book, you discuss Pia shamanism and Alleluia shamanism and Kanema shamanism. Could you give us some detail on those?
I mean, the way it sort of roughly breaks down is this, and actually there's a sort of myth story which goes along with at least the origins of Pia and Kanaima shamanism. For the original maker of the world was Makunaima, And he also made all the poisonous and biting things in this world. And the oldest form of shamanism is Canaima. And we can talk, obviously, more about that in a moment. So let me first just say how that is differentiated from Pia. For Macanaima also has a brother, Piatma. And Piatma went behind Macanaima's back and had an affair with his wife. And he plotted with Macanaima's wife to kill him. Well, they didn't quite manage that, but they did chop him in the leg, and he went up to become the star Orion. And from that mythic moment, also attention, a differentiation in practice began between the shamans who sort of followed the way of Piatma, who gave all the tools of sociality, or those who followed Macanaima, the Canaima, the ancient creator of the world, and if you like, the sort of lord of the dark things. So really Pia and Canaima are differentiated by the emphasis of Pia on the construction and maintenance of village life, of curing, and, you know, to some extent of divination. Canaima kind of stands outside of the social world, the normal everyday social world of villages and farmers and chiefs, and really have struck a cosmic bargain with Macanaima, whose anger at his treatment, especially by the men who turned then to the shamanism of his brother, would otherwise predate upon the world, would eat the souls of the Patamona and all other people, were it not for the Canaima who, through their ritual practice, produce human sacrificial victims, which appease Macanaima, empower his shamans of the Canaima, and in a very important detail, they do this in a way which is beyond the ability of the Pia shaman to otherwise cure. So we have two very distinct systems operating somewhat independently, but, you know, entwined through this originary moment of betrayal of Piatma of his brother Macanaima. Now, Alleluia is extremely interesting. It is, in fact, much more recent. And indeed, to some extent, we can, you know, give it a fairly precise history. For it, it represents shamanic innovation, invention, the creation of a new shamanic complex. And the word Alleluia, as you might guess, comes from the exposure of the Patamona in the 19th century to British missionaries. But not so much because the missionaries, in fact, stayed and converted and, you know, induced the Patamona to become good Anglicans, good Episcopalians, if you like. But rather, in a very interesting way, this exposure to elements of Christianity convinced people that, in fact, the missionaries were hiding Christianity or access to the Christian God, whoever that was, for the Amerindians. And that, therefore, in the vision of the first prophet of Alleluia, a Makushi, another tribe, a Makushi man called Bichiwung, has a vision, and he goes up to visit the Christian God, and the Christian God gives him songs, some magical texts, and a bottle of white medicine. And he then proceeds to spread, as it were, this new form of shamanism, and it in turn is, if not exactly antagonistic, again, sort of distinct both from Piatma or PR shamanism, and Kanaima. And in particular, it seems that it was a style of shamanism which kind of rendered null and void, in some spiritual sense, the power particularly of the Kanaima to do harm. And so Alleluia had a really wide distribution up in the highlands, not just amongst the Patamona, but can be taken in some ways as something rather like the, with which your listeners might be more familiar, the ghost dance or the peyote church here in North America. So there it is.
So these types of shamanism are actually acting as a balance, forms of balance between each other then, in a way.
Well, I don't, no, not exactly. I mean, it would be kind of neat from the point of view of anthropological explanation to kind of do a sort of functionalism, you know, and everything sort of balances and becomes stable over time. But actually, I think all those forms of shamanism themselves are in a very dynamic historical phenomena. And insofar as I, or myself and others, have been able to reconstruct histories of these practices, you know, one can certainly say whatever it is today, there's no reason to assume it was the same 100 years ago, just as we would say of any other religious or spiritual practice. So although indeed their references are very ancient and deep, as indeed perhaps, you know, one might consider Christianity at least a couple of thousand years old, but of course we know it's been a very dynamic spiritual practice through time and has, you know, morphed and changed and had different kinds of social and cultural consequence. And I think that's the case with shamanism as well. And indeed, you know, as the case of Alleluia shows, it's, as it were, you know, recently born, becomes a very dynamic force on the scene and may look very sort of ancient now, but because we are able to somewhat intersect its origins historically, we can actually say, you know, well, it's probably about 150 years old.
Let me ask you, in your book you talk about the original anthropologists and ethnographers thinking that Kanaima was just some delusion of the Amerindian people. Could you talk about
that? And let me say, you know, also, I mean, I don't know if we're, perhaps we'll come back to talk to this as well, but I noticed, I mean, I don't, you said in your introduction that there's been a sort of suppression of, you know, knowledge about this. And I don't think that's so much the case as, you know, as an inherently difficult subject and one which, after all, you know, does not necessarily come away with the happiest story. And in a world, you know, which is all too ready to leap on people who, you know, have different kinds of ways of going about things, you know, the kind of negative, darker side of things always has to be handled carefully. Now, and in the same way, I don't think, you know, really, you know, anthropology itself, at least, you know, the kind of professional face that it has now in North America, you know, that's only about 100 years or so old. And I think really a lot of the writing on Kanaima, you know, the 19th century is by missionaries, colonial administrators. There, you know, are some anthropologists in there or proto-anthropologists in there. But again, I think, you know, the atmosphere has very much been then and now that these are disappearing lifeways. So, you know, the real job is to document the mainstream, you know, what's very evident. And in that context, the rather esoteric practices of dark shamans who are anyway difficult and somewhat unpleasant to encounter don't always get high on the list. So I think it's a combination of, you know, yes, kind of don't want to go there attitude, and I do think that that's perfectly understandable. And I think it's also, you know, connected to a sense of urgency, perhaps now I would say misplaced, but nonetheless a sense of urgency as to the necessity of documenting other kinds of more central phenomena, and the fact that, you know, as I say, a lot anyway about Canaima isn't really written by anthropologists as such. I mean, it's very sad to contemplate, but, you know, probably there are only three or four professional anthropologists, five or six professional anthropologists, you know, actively interested in Guyana, that region right now. So we're also, you know, there's not many people, so not everything gets equal coverage, as in the case of the Patamona, more generally.
Well, you know, and from your reading your book, it seems like a lot of the anthropologists sort of omit it and give a rosy history of what shamanism is. And what...
I think for the kind of reasons I say, and, you know, I mean, what I want to point out is that at the same time, the other book, In Darkness and Secrecy, you know, lines up sort of, 15 people or more who, you know, on being asked, do have this kind of information and are, you know, willing to write about it. So I think, you know, it is a balance of, you know, the distasteful nature to some of the subject, and the fact that, professionally, it's not always what people want to hear. So I think, you know, there is a lot going on there, but I don't think it's a simple case of, you know, suppressing it all.
In Darkness and Secrecy, you and Robin Wright wrote, quote, "Shamanism is a burgeoning obsession for the middle classes around the globe. Its presentation in popular books, TV specials, and on the internet is dominated by the presumed psychic and physical benefits that shamanic techniques can bring. This heightened interest has required a persistent purification of the ritual practices of those who inspire the feverish quest for personal meaning and fulfillment. Ironically, as Fasto points out in his essay in this volume, In Darkness and Secrecy, given the self-improvement motivations that have brought so many into popular understanding of shamanism, two defining aspects of shamanism in Amazonia, blood, i.e. violence, and tobacco, have simply been erased from such representations. Such erasure is not only a vain self-deception, but more important, it is a recapitulation of colonial ways of knowing through both the denial of radical cultural difference and refusal to think through its consequences."
Absolutely.
And I think...
But I mean, the rhetoric is, you know, more directed to, you know, not anthropologists working in Amazonia so much as those who, you know, kind of pick up on the secondary literature. I mean, it's a, you know, statement about how in popular terms I think much shamanism is understood. Now, certainly, you know, I think we are, you know, sort of pioneering this aspect of things. So I think that's the case, but as I, you know, have been stressing, I think the reason it hasn't been taken up is less to do perhaps with, you know, a kind of willful sort of ignoring of realities than it is, you know, the fact that there's a pressing agenda in other senses. But more widely, and in a figure like Michael Harner, for example, most certainly, you know, academics have been no less responsible than anyone else, you know, for, you know, promoting this rather cheery image. So, you know, it is, as I say, you know, I think there's a number of reasons why this kind of topic doesn't get talked about as much as it might. But at the same time, I, you know, absolutely stick by what we say in Darkness and Secrecy, in that I think, quite apart from whether people are prepared to engage this kind of material, it is certainly the case anyway that the whole sort of idea of shamanism has been terribly bloated and elaborated out of all proportion to any of the, you know, realities that we encounter as anthropologists anyway.
Well, on my forum on the GnosticMedia.com website, I actually have a section there dedicated to dark shamanism, and I think it's probably the only place I've seen anywhere online that, other than yourself, that is even focused or even, for that matter, discussing the issue.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think people necessarily want to hear this. And, certainly making presentations on such topics in meetings, professional meetings, can draw the kind of reaction that, really can't you find anything more, positive to talk about? So, there's definitely professional pressure to talk about other things. I applaud you absolutely for very much being prepared to, think about this material, because it certainly poses a lot of problems. There's no doubt that Canaima ritual killing is homicide. It is very cruel. And it absolutely would be considered criminal under any standard legal system. But of course, the challenge then is to understand and hopefully explain why, despite that, it is something that needs to be taken seriously. In my own case, ultimately respected. But certainly, is not sort of a candidate for suppression either intellectually or, by more direct means. For in many ways, I think our ideas about terrorism share a lot with how people react to ideas of witchcraft or dark shamanism. So we're also at a moment where I think for lots of reasons, we need to think very carefully about the violence of others and how it may be related or how it stands in comparison to our own evidently violent capacities.
And I must thank you for bringing a balance to this entire field of research, because really, without your work and possibly Wade Davis's, there's really nothing else out there on this topic.
No, and I think there are some often practical reasons why not. I mean, it is not the sort of thing that you would recommend people to do necessarily. To some extent, all of us tend to kind of find ourselves sort of in this situation, if not by accident, kind of coming in sideways without necessarily having that as an intention. But there are also some good anthropological writings from Africa on similar kinds of topic. And I'm thinking there is a very good volume on the Songhai sorcerers and a similar kind of experience. And of course, I'm blanking as I talk on the exact details on that, but I could certainly send those materials and perhaps you can post them. But generally, yes, this is not a topic that has received anything like the attention it should, principally because it is not a small part of shamanism at all. And the PI, for all the fact that they're not Canaima in the system of shamanisms that I've just been talking about, they're perfectly capable of causing immense harm as well. I mean, the real principle at play here is that the ability to cure entails the ability to harm. The very knowledge that allows you, as it were, in their idiom, to put the soul back in the body is the very same thing which, of course, as in the case of a Canaima attack, can drive it utterly out. And that's important to bring to what we're trying, what people's interests are in the shamanism as they so far understand it. And it's very notable, for example, in again I mentioned this man Michael Harner, who was a professional anthropologist and a professor, and he runs the Institute of Shamanic Studies now, but His book on shamanism, you know, explicitly and in class discussion, we felt rather irresponsibly suggest that the, you know, the, while the dark side is there, it's something that, you know, can simply be bypassed. And of course, as ever, it's always dangerous to fool with things that are not fully understood, or at least understood better than they might be.
Can't
So
it
there is a concern too with that.
be just as dangerous to leave it undiscussed so that there's a layer of ignorance there instead? I mean, what if somebody went down to South America and wanted to go do an ayahuasca tour and ended up in the wrong place with the wrong tribe and the wrong people? Couldn't that be equally as dangerous?
Oh yeah, I mean absolutely. You know what I'm saying is, I think you know the problem is, you know, pretending that this aspect of shamanism is not present opens the door to precisely the kinds of tragic consequences that you allude to.
Okay.
And also, I think you know it does, of course, you know, it really whitewashes indigenous culture, and it really takes away so much of its complexity. Because I think the importance of this for us is not just, you know, oh, there's something interesting, but rather, you know, for me, it's very much been a case of teaching me things about the nature of violence that I think can be very usefully brought home, as it were. After all, for all the violence of the Canaima, I mean, it has nothing compared to the daily violence that our own society enacts. So, you know, it's really ultimately the measured violence, the measured nature of the violence, and that the way in that which that is turned to effective social use that ultimately seems to me to be very important to think about in regard of what's going on, as much as it might be, you know, a dramatic and kind of sort of exotic example of other savagery.
So you are the survivor of a dark shaman attack, is that correct?
Well, yes, I mean, in that I, you know, as I, you know, tell more fully in my book, as a result of, you know, the dynamics around researching this topic, I was poisoned. However, it was not at all, I think, intended to be, or you know, involve the sort of actions that a Canaima, a specific Canaima killing, might. I think it was very much a warning of sorts.
So tell me what led you into, you know, from studying anthropology to indigenous cultures of South America, what led you specifically into researching dark shamanism? What was the key event
Yeah.
that turned your path?
Well, I mean, I think, as I said, if we'd have gone back before 2000, you'd have seen that I was like getting pretty violent already. You know, my doctoral work, right, was on a group called the Caribs, and that name, Carib, is the root of our term cannibal. You know, and a topic which I've returned to in the latest volume about Hans Staden. So, you know, issues of indigenous violence, initially in the form of ritual cannibalism and more latterly, you know, with regard to shamanic assault, you know, this has been a consistent interest over a number of years, as well as, of course, the violence of the colonial movement itself.
So, as far as your poisoning, what were the effects of the poison? Do you have any idea what they used on you, or I mean, if you know, if it was just a warning, if an,
Yeah.
and if it was a warning, then maybe the woman did, or the woman who cooked your food did poison you intentionally.
Well, yes, but I mean, I'm not a policeman, so I don't want to start making, it's a serious allegation. So, I mean, in narrating what happened, I can certainly vent suspicions, but that's all they are. And, I can't tell really what they used. It was probably based on some plant, from the ginger family, which is the basis of a number of astringents and poisons in a shamanic practice. But the effects are, a great explosion of the bowels, of course, and, eventually what seems to be incipient kidney damage as you're passing blood. So, it was very alarming at the time. But in fact, well, all I really had as an option was to try and consult some sort of shamanic or herbal remedy, which I did, and this indeed seemed to work. So again, I think this was intended, maybe not even, I don't even suspect really to kill, because I think the political consequences of doing that for the Padamona, or even for the, those who bear you ill will, would have, certainly been beyond what they really would have liked to have happened. I mean, although one is not in a super privileged position, nonetheless, that would have hit the news in Georgetown, if not elsewhere, and no doubt that would have provoked, some kind of police action. So I think it was, carefully judged.
So, I seem to remember from your book that you were actually even threatened and followed, and you had somebody messing with your hut while you were sleeping and things like that too. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, on later visits, I mean, I was much more careful about my food, but yeah, strange incidents in the night, a kind of depressingly regular appearance of, venomous snakes in the hut. And, I think these are sort of standard kinds of tactic by the Canaima, a way in which, they do attempt to manipulate people's emotional and subjective state. Even, if they don't, even if they don't necessarily intend to assassinate, it's part of, a projection of their power and their ability to find you and let you know they can find you.
So is that the purpose of the Canaima? Is it to just to control? Is it political control? What purpose does
Well,
the Canaima
that's
serve?
really, that was the sort of earlier misrepresentation. It was assimilated to some kind of, legalistic social control. But as I was saying earlier, it in fact is not a system of, political enforcement or sort of revenge even between families, but a form of shamanism in which the killing is connected to this cosmological purpose of, feeding Makunaima, as it were, in order to, obviate his need to go himself, as it were, and eat human souls without any kind of, control or restriction. So it's a kind of, ancient cosmic pact, as it were, between Makunaima and these shamans. And this is also why, there is to some degree a real toleration of what they do.
Do you see any parallels between the Canaima and the shamans of South America and our own society here?
Well, I mean, perhaps less in terms of, well, put it this way. I mean, one comparison that actually we make in that Darkness and Secrecy book is that, perhaps in Western societies, the state itself is a kind of death shaman. It controls our destiny. It has control over our, violence and killing. And you know, it through various kinds of marvels and wonders, you know, projects itself as this powerful and inevitable force in everyone's lives. So, you know, that's not necessarily an analogy which is going to appeal to a political scientist, but it does begin to call attention, as you know, some wider anthropological literature has, to the magic of the state and the way in which, in many ways, the kinds of performance and skills of divination, of curing, and of killing, very much, you know, what shamans do, have as it were, in an institutional way, been arrogated by the modern state. You know, which of course has otherwise sidelined spirituality in a lot of ways, and has sort of now this presence in everyone's life that, you know, might well bear analogy or thought as to how God or other kinds of theistic concepts at earlier times in earlier ways provided the rationale for various kinds of priestly or specialized ritual action, like human sacrifice. And of course, you know, the death penalty and certainly, you know, hanging and other exotic and, you know, previous forms of execution have been directly likened to forms of human sacrifice, having a similar place in the, you know, medieval and early modern state that perhaps, you know, it did for the Aztec.
Yeah, well, that's a very interesting point. I don't know if I had considered that before. So, well, what happens if a Kadema's attack is successful? I would obviously think that the person would eventually die, but
Yeah, I
what's
mean, they're mutilated in the mouth and anus, which is basically stripped out, and, you know, various magical substances are rammed up the anal tract, and the mouth is, you know, savagely punctured with the fangs of a venomous snake, which causes the mouth to swell up. So basically, you can't take any food or liquid. Nor can you control evacuation. You know, your constant diarrhea. So pretty soon it's you know, death through dehydration basically, and that, you know, is maybe 2 or 3 days. So it's a very, very unpleasant, but highly, of course, arresting and symbolically significant way of killing. Which marks it, you know, as it did for me when I first sort of understood or heard what was happening, as surely, you know, something much more complicated than, you know, murder. So, you know, the very elaborate nature of the form of killing really signals the way in which it serves purposes which, at least initially, cannot be assimilated simply to our categories of murder, homicide, or revenge.
And once the person dies, it doesn't end there, does it? You talk about the honey of Necrosis or Maba. Could you
Yeah, I
discuss
mean,
that?
well, the point of that ritual treatment is to prepare, as it were, a vessel composed of flesh, which, you know, in conjunction with these herbal substances, which you know, begin a kind of cellular breakdown, just like any kind of marinade, if you will. You know, that produces within the stomach cavity. Certain kind, you know, certain fluids as a result of necrosis, and that is called maba, a word that, you know, literally means honey. And they aim to recover some of that fluid, which they, the action of which is, you know, both kind of psychotropic, and also, very bodily, as it is narrated, in that it both gives a sort of sense of, being superhuman and capable of all kinds of transformation and even flight, of course.
And
it's also important, as a way of, as it were, escaping, the sort of state that you put yourself in when you do such a killing. So it's also, a way in which one can return to a more human kind of existence. And they say you would die if that doesn't happen, that it would kill you eventually, remaining in the state of Canaima assassin. So the Maba is an antidote in a curious way as well.
Huh. Is what? How do they get to the Maba?
Well, basically, as it's told, insert a cane straight through the stomach, into the stomach cavity. But I think that sort of that there is a kind of festive image to the way this is narrated, and I think in more practical terms, they find the corpse and exhume it.
Can you talk a little bit about the process of a Kanema shamanic initiation? What would a new Kanema shaman go through, or what do they do? Do you have any idea about that?
Well, as with a lot of shamanic initiation, there is great stress on fasting and drinking tobacco juice as a way to kind of alter consciousness. In the case of Kanaima, this is going to also, of course, involve taking part in this ritual killing. So, when Kanaimas act, they do so as a small group in which, some will be more expert than others, and, there's a kind of training as you go along, as it were. But in many ways, other aspects of initiation are not hugely dissimilar from, what would be classically understood as this sort of process of putting yourself into a different kind of state, and in that position, become more able to interact and sort of perceive a new world of spirit beings of various kinds, who then become your allies or your enemies, as it were, for the kinds of work that you want to do.
Well, you mentioned tobacco use. Do you know what other plants or poisons that they use for initiation, or is it primarily tobacco?
Tobacco is really key. I mean, there is no real use of hallucinogens at all, which is, of course, quite distinct from many other regions of South America. But, really, the eastern half of South America is really, it's tobacco. And it's only in the western parts of the Amazon that you really have the sort of stress on particular use of, Banisteriopsis and the like, ayahuasca.
Right.
So, but don't underestimate tobacco. I mean, we only know it in rather puny varieties that you get here. But, I mean, the real stuff is, boy, that is very, very strong. And it's, of course, a very powerful narcotic.
And that's Nicotiana rustica? Or
yeah,
which?
Exactly.
Okay.
But they grow, all kinds of, as it said, the swallow-tailed kite, is the guardian of tobacco, and every shaman is given a special leaf by the swallow-tailed kite, and that's his own sort of line of tobacco. And so, they're very obviously alert to, quite small differences between plants and varieties. So, that's a whole high science in its own right.
So why do you think the use of tobacco in shamanism is so understated as far as I mean, except for your work, I
Well, I
and
mean, you're in California,
right,
yeah?
correct.
Well, I probably can't have a cigarette with my meal, right?
Yeah.
In other words, we've stigmatized tobacco,
Right.
so, I don't think, I mean, I think there is a kind of suppression going on, right? It's what we say, it's part of the erasures that's going on.
But don't you feel that all of the entheogens have really been stigmatized to a much even greater degree than tobacco?
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, at this point in time, I mean, somehow ayahuasca seems to be more socially acceptable than tobacco. But I mean that, it is a changing, landscape. And your broader point, of course, I absolutely agree with. From cannabis, through opium, coca, tobacco. Yes, I mean, this pharmacratic regime, I think as you've termed it, I think it's a very good phrase, and I think that's exactly the
Pharmacratic
point. That's a very
Inquisition.
interesting, right, but I mean, let me call it a regime. There's some very interesting work going on right now in another kind of realm of academia on exactly this, thinking about, the way our bodies are still run by a pharmacratic regime, but one, in which the main sort of drugs are Prozac and, Cialis, Viagra, aspirin,
Right.
and so it goes on, right?
Right.
And, they play with the water, right? In other words, there is a real control of the substances in and out of our bodies. It's not so much their absence, it's just the pharmacratic regime we have is one that's tied closely to a, billion-dollar pharmaceutical industry, right? And that is, the dynamic there. The use of these other plants that we've been talking about are, have been, as you know, historically governed by, shamanic and spiritual ideas. So I think there's a very important difference in the pharmacratic regimes of East and South America and those of, modern Euro-America.
I was just looking for the word of it. You probably know it right off the top of your head, but oh, let's see. I don't remember the name of it.
The word for.
Well, I wanted to ask you if you could talk about shape-shifting and shamanism and kanema and that sort of thing.
Tupac. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think what's important here to grasp is really, the way in which not just within shamanism but more generally in indigenous ideas there is a sort of real instability. I mean, the categories of the human, the animal, and the divine don't have the kind of sharp and absolute boundaries that they do in our thinking. And so, transformation, as it were, between such categories is more subtle and less problematic than, we imagine it to be. So, we perhaps think of, some old Lon Chaney film when we think about, werewolves or transformations into jaguars. But it's rather more that, what we might perceive as a jaguar has, these human potentials just as humans have these jaguaristic potentials. So that what you're looking at, you can never be quite sure. In other words, it's less, some kind of, anti-Newtonian physical principle than, the recognition that surface appearance is not always a guide to the nature of what you're looking at.
Is there a relation to sex and sexual control and kanaima with eating the victim and things like that?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say in, you know, there are other other sort of cultural contexts in which, you know, that is written much larger. In other words, what I, you know, mean to say is I'm not saying sex is absent, but I don't think it's foregrounded in the way it might be, you know, in other regions. So, you know, I thought of trying to think a lot about this, and you know, I think, yes, informally, I mean, the Canaima is sort of even available as a kind of erotic figure, you know, in the way that dark and powerful people often are. But, you know, I haven't gone for the idea that even though, you know, there is sort of extensive mutilation of the mouth and anus, that, you know, it is productive to initially, anyway, try and read this as sexualized in our understanding of that term. But clearly, you know, all these kinds of bodily manipulation certainly, you know, invoke and are capable of stimulating sexual response.
What other tribes or societies in South America practice dark shamanism? Are there any others, or is it limited to the Patamuna?
Yeah. I mean, and the book In Darkness and Secrecy was very much an attempt to show how broad, in fact, this is. You know, in other words, it's everywhere. It is always there if shamanism is there. The issue is, will people talk to you about it? Are you able to recognize it? And, you know, how you might sort of try and learn more about it. So it's always there. I mean, you know, I would say that, you know, it's just not possible to you know, believe the suggestion, no, there's nothing like this that goes on amongst the so-and-so. I think it's always there for the kind of logical reasons that we talked about earlier, the way in which, you know, curing must necessarily imply an ability to kill. It is that knowledge of, you know, physiology, be that, you know, anatomical or spiritual. But it's that knowledge of, you know, how people are put together that allows you to mend them and destroy them. So it's always there. But of course, you know, Christian persecution, if nothing else, has pretty much ensured throughout the Americas that people don't really want to talk about this necessarily, both because, you know, it can be quite literally dangerous to do so in their own terms, but also, you know, they're also aware of the sort of campaigns of suppressing Satan and witchcraft, which missionaries and others are all too happy to carry out.
Well, you mentioned how healing and dark shamanism are related. Could you talk about how the Patamuna believe, what they believe that is the origin of sickness and disease?
Well, I mean, it's part of the nature of the world. But, you know, in more sort of immediate terms, there's no such thing as a kind of accidental death. There's no such thing as, you know, simply, even though, you know, people are perfectly able to recognize that someone's, say, dying of malaria, you know, the etiology here is not just connected with, you know, thinking about, okay, what, you know, some mosquito must have bitten them, but also, well, why? Why, you know, why me or why that person? And why then and not at another time? Even if all these, you know, standard explanations that we have, even if they're ever present, of course, as we ask ourselves, you know, why did I get ill right now? You know, why not a day later or a day after? And the answer to that question is, you know, always located in the potential malice and, you know, ill will that others or other spirit forces might harbor towards you. So it's always, you know, there's never a sort of coincidence as such.
So how is, basically what you're saying is that if somebody gets a disease or a sickness, then somebody else is accused of causing it. Is that correct? It's not just, they don't know about virology and things like that, so they're going to think that.
Yeah, they do. I mean, they do, or, I mean, I don't think, I mean, the point here is even if you do, that doesn't tell you why at that point in time, why, the microbes moved in the way they did, why the person next to you didn't get the flu, right? And that, that gap in understanding is filled by reference, to the way in which people acting through or as shamans can have these effects on the world. So it's a, an interactive and participatory universe. It's not a universe in which, physical and Newtonian process unfolds mechanically until finally, we all disappear into, the blackness of space. But it's a place in which, anyone, right? Because all people are potentially shamans, in which anyone can intersect and react and interact with the very forces that govern how the world and all things work. So it's a, profoundly encouraging scenario in some ways. Maybe not everything's right, but we most certainly can do things about that.
So if somebody is accused of sorcery, what is done to that person, and are they always guilty?
Well, I mean, what's guilt here? I mean, who doesn't, have envy and spite for their neighbors at times? So, it's hard to give a general answer because how that accusation arises and plays out, can differ very, very substantially in some contexts. In a Patamona context right now, nothing's going to happen. Absolutely nothing's going to happen. And these guys are walking around, right in front of you. And no one can do anything, so they're not going to make accusation as such. But, their reasons, their understanding of the reasons of death will, nonetheless be of the sort I've said. In other contexts, such accusations is, perhaps certainly earlier amongst the Patamona, even today amongst, other groups, will, lead to a kind of witch hunt. And perhaps indeed those people will be killed. But this is, something that depends on if there is a sort of functioning, village authority or some kind of chiefly authority. One of the problems with the Patamona at the moment, as it were, is having been decapitated by the colonial and national governments. The police not really being interested, or even at least as an institution, being prepared to believe in such things. The connivers pretty much go about their business as they wish. But certainly in past times, if their depredations had got too much, then the warriors would have, clubbed them to death.
Could you discuss more about the use of tobacco and how they use it, and as well as you mentioned jaguars earlier. I seem to remember something in your book about how there's a general misinterpretation of jaguars and panthers in relation to ayahuasca versus tobacco use and the shamanism of the area.
Not quite sure what you're alluding to there, but I mean, certainly, again, as we were saying earlier, this is really a very important zone, part of the world for tobacco use. The jaguar really enters as the sort of shaman's double, if you like. I mean, this is a classic form for the shaman to take. thereby, becomes this almost obsessive figure in mythology and thinking. So that, not surprisingly, the jaguar is certainly a central symbol, is good to think with in Amazonia.
And since your work into dark shamanism, you've published on the different aspects of violence. Can you talk about the studies that you've done in that regard?
Yeah, well, as a result exactly of, the sort of dangers and difficulties of working any more on this Kanaima topic, I mean, you reach a point where, you've burnt up all the favors that you have, and, to be honest, short of, actually witnessing and becoming more involved in these rituals, there's nowhere else to go. And that, of course, sets a limit. But, of course, it also provokes the thought that, violence more broadly then, perhaps in some sense, becomes off limits. But this isn't a good result. We must be able to talk about violence. This is clearly a fundamental human quality. It's quite clearly a major problem for us now. So if an ethnographer cannot, as it were, become witness to violence, even being witnesses to really be going along with the violence, perhaps in some ways, how are we going to talk about this? And this really led me, perhaps to make a sort of unusual turn in that in thinking about, where the expression, of sexuality and violence is permissible in some senses, then, the whole kind of explosion in cyber life seemed at least, interesting to think about, particularly, relating again to shamanism, coming to understand that, something like Kanaima really exists, not just, or perhaps even not, in its major way as a physical act of assassination, but exists very powerfully, more persistently, more widely, as a sort of category of the imagination. In concluding that study of shamanism, I looked at the ways in which the figure of the Kanaima traveled, had become, a novel by Romulo Gallegos, a former president of Venezuela, enters into the literature of Guyana and the Caribbean, a number of times, is the subject of poetry, is the subject even of a role-playing game emanating from Brazil. So, like vampires, there's a point at which these figures, become powerful in people's imagination beyond, as it were, the original context where they have this particular physical kind of referent and characteristic. So maybe this too was, not the same, of course, as watching people bleed and die. But then, given how problematic that would be, perhaps the next best thing is to precisely study how people's imaginations work. Because before an act of violence ever takes place of any kind, it's first rehearsed imaginatively. And I think this is shown to us by the way in which, violent killing, acts of violence, are remarkably conditioned by, cultural context. The way people kill and wound each other, in other words, is part of, their general culture. It's not something that everyone makes up for themselves. When someone goes to hurt another, the way they do it reflects their understanding given to them by their culture as to what is appropriate or correct what would be considered, the right way to do this. And, this also, when you think about it, begins to help us understand, why, in the former Yugoslavia they kill people with hammers. Why, in the genocide in Rwanda there was this sort of whole philosophy of how people should be killed with machetes. And these do, when you put them against the background of the broader culture, you can begin to see how they reflect some sort of very important values that that culture has, not just, with regard to violence, but broader human concept. And so it is for us. After all, part of the reason we were so shocked at Abu Ghraib was that this was not our idea of how Americans are violent. So we have our own, ideas as well about what the right way to be violent is. And therefore, I think the study of the imaginary and the imagination is not to study something which is not real. It's just to study something which is not material. And in doing so, perhaps then we are able to say something about violence that is useful and relevant.
How are myth, magic, and violence used for social control?
Well, it's kind of like that shamanic state we were talking about earlier. I mean, I think the deployment, of myth, magic, and violence are at the heart of, most projects of social control. Because they speak, myth and violence, if you like, at least, in those, in a very sort of basic and simplistic understanding of those terms, are then, the imaginary and the material that I've just been talking about. The magic becomes indeed the ideology or the, cultural understanding of how exactly those things interrelate. So, this is exactly society's conversation with itself.
What do you want people to remember who are interested in the study of shamanism?
Well, I think consistent with, what we've been talking about throughout, that it is a much more complicated, much more ambiguous phenomena than, broadly we've been given to understand. And that appreciating that, rather than, belittling what shamanism is, shows it to be a truly profound set of ideas that, like all the other major religions of the world, deal with the key and fundamental question of death and resurrection, that ultimate issue for all of us. And shamanism, taken as only some kind of folk curing, feel better kind of psychodynamic encounter group, I think sadly and quite reprehensibly fails then to come anywhere close to allowing us to appreciate the sophistication of thought that's going on here.
And do you have any final statements that you would like to make?
Well, I guess apart from be careful out there, I really encourage everyone to not take for granted always, the pictures they're presented with, to, be very critical, especially of those professors and professionals. But at the same time, to, also realize that I think the effort to, engage systematically and sympathetically through something like ethnography is a very powerful tool, not just for coming to understand others, but ultimately, I think, coming to understand ourselves.
And we've been speaking with Professor Neil Whitehead on dark shamanism. This is Gnostic Media Podcast number 6. And Neil, thank you for your time today. I really appreciate you coming on the show, and hopefully we can get this ambiguous side of shamanism more well known and discussed out there in the public.
Absolutely, Jan. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. Your questions were just fantastic. Really has given me the opportunity to express some ideas that have become not just intellectually but personally very important. So thank you for this opportunity.
You're welcome. Maybe we can do it again sometime.
You bet.